Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
We've lost people to Starbucks. They're all paying more hourly than we do, and the work is hard. Head Start is hard.
Head Start programs in Alaska could lose millions in federal funding because of under-enrollment. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 21st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the state pushes back on research that says predator control doesn't work.
The areas that didn't have wolf control stayed at low density. The 4 areas that did have wolf control increased in abundance and they allowed more harvest.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
Officials say no survivors were found after a helicopter carrying 4 people crashed in a shallow lake on the North Slope. The helicopter had been chartered by a government agency, according to the company that operated the flight. It was reported overdue late Thursday night. DJ Fowski, the North Slope Borough's Director of Government and External Affairs, said in a text to the Associated Press today that a borough search and rescue team in a helicopter found debris matching the description of the missing helicopter, but no bodies had been seen or recovered. The helicopter was operated by Maritime Helicopters, according to a statement on the company's website. It confirmed the accident and said names of the pilot and passengers would be released pending notification of next of kin. It was not immediately known what agency had chartered the flight. Almost half of Alaska's Head Start early learning programs are in danger of losing millions of dollars in federal funding due to under-enrollment. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, some say staffing is the biggest issue.
Head Start is a federal program that provides early childhood education for free, primarily to low-income families as well as foster kids and children with disabilities.
We work with not just the kids, but the families, and that's what makes Head Start different. Head Start tries to help the family get on track, learn how to advocate for their kid, navigate the special ed system if they need it, set family goals.
That's Ann Shade, director for the Child Development Department with Bristol Bay Native Association, one of 17 Head Start grantees in Alaska. The program is funded for 80 children total, from the hub community of Dillingham to the villages of Togiak, Nustuyahok, and Manicotic. But right now, it only has staffing to fill 53 of the spots, and its federal grant is at risk. In a letter that BBNA received at the end of May, officials with the Federal Office of Head Start gave the program a year to increase its enrollment numbers, or else it could lose just shy of $600,000 in federal funding.
It would severely cripple it. We've got a $1.6 million Head Start grant, but you know, it's not like you can drop 5 kids or 10 kids because you have to drop a whole classroom to save any money. And each classroom, runs at about $100,000 a year.
The potential loss of Head Start funding comes as the state faces a child care crunch, with lengthy wait lists and rising costs putting a burden on Alaska families. In total, officials with the Alaska Head Start Association say that the 8 Head Start programs that have been contacted by the federal government could potentially lose as much as $12.5 million in funding due to under-enrollment. Shade says BBNA's biggest issue for enrolling kids is staffing, since there's a ratio requirement for teachers to children.
Each of our classrooms has 3 people in it and 16 kids. So if I don't have, you know, people in the classroom, I can't serve kids.
She says it's been difficult to compete with wages in other industries, some of which are less demanding.
Somebody lost somebody to Bailey's Furniture. We've lost people to Starbucks. They're all paying more hourly than we do, and the work is hard. Head Start is hard.
Additionally, some say there are barriers to entry that make hiring for Head Start programs difficult. Francine Kachucha is director of early childhood education with the Fairbanks Native Association, another Head Start grantee that is currently under-enrolled by about 53%. She says while their wages are fairly competitive, the program has had issues with applicants not passing drug tests. Additionally, she says there's a backlog of background checks at the state and federal levels holding up the hiring process.
When I called in to check, they said, yeah, we're short-staffed just like you guys.
A spokeswoman for the State Department of Health says there are currently no pending background check applications for Head Start. Kachucha says her Head Start program has a wait list of students ready to enroll once they hire more people. It was alerted in January that it could lose more than $3 million in federal funding due to under-enrollment. Kachucha says that funding loss could impact paying for the building and salaries and could result in the closure of classrooms. She also worries that a decrease in Head Start spaces could lead parents to send their kids to pricier alternatives.
It's very expensive. It's $700 or more a month for families per child. So families simply can't afford childcare.
Head Start program managers say they'd hoped to get an increase in state funding so they could raise childcare salaries to help with recruitment. This year, legislators had allocated an additional $5 million to Head Start, but Governor Mike Dunleavy vetoed the amount, reducing it to $1.5 million. The federal government notified Head Start programs about the under-enrollment before the governor's veto. Shade with BBNA says the federal government requires a 20% match in funding from a non-federal source, and the state of Alaska had covered that cost for years.
Over the years, as the funding has remained flat funded, that percentage has dropped to somewhere around 12% right now. And so if we would have been given the extra $5 million, that would have covered everybody's non-federal share.
For now, Shade hopes that the state will begin addressing child care concerns with the creation of a child care task force by Dunleavy. The next meeting of the task force will be July 26th. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
More than 100 Bristol Bay fishing crews outraged with this year's base sockeye salmon price anchored their boats in the Naknek River entrance on Thursday. The protesting crews are calling on Alaska processors to reconsider their historic low price and bring more price transparency to the fishery. KDLG's Jesse Sheldon reports.
At 9 a.m., Ivan Basarjan and the crew of his boat, the fishing vessel Top Notch, are on the water to protest this year's low price. He's fished in Bristol Bay since the late 1980s. Standing in the wheelhouse of a boat he built, he says this year's price hits hard.
So this 50 cents that I get when I get home is going to be a wash. You know, I'm not going to have anything in the bank sitting.
Organizers of the protest are calling on processors to increase the base price this season of 50 cents per pound, less than half of last year's price. If it doesn't change, many fishermen say it's unsustainable for the industry, and some say they will go home in debt. Basarjan says he's out on the water today because he fears accepting this year's low base price will set a precedent.
If they know we can fish for 50 cents, we're going to get paid 30 cents next year. This is just a peaceful protest. You know, we're not trying to block anybody or anything. You know, we're just trying to show the world that we're hurting and we need some help.
Trident Seafoods was the first to post that base price on Sunday with some handling incentives. North Pacific Seafoods announced the same a few days later, along with Peter Pan Seafoods. KDLG made repeated email and phone call requests for comment with the largest processors, Trident Seafoods, OBI Seafoods, North Pacific Seafoods, Silver Bay Seafoods, and Peter Pan Seafoods, which have not been returned. In their letter to the fleet, Trident Seafoods cites last year's record harvest as surplus flooding the market, as well as dropping consumer demand as factors in this year's low base price. Basarjan says while processors claim they are struggling financially too, he hasn't seen that.
I see processors expanding. I see them buying other companies out. If you look at the scenario, kind of seems like, you know, they're putting a burden on us and they're adding up, you know, their profits and expanding their operations.
Organizers are also calling for processors to post a base price ahead of the season. In recent years, Peter Pan Seafoods posted a price in mid-June, which was welcomed by fishermen. This year, processors did not release a price in Bristol Bay before fishing started. Now, the season is almost over. Fran Call, a longtime captain, says with prior knowledge of the low price, fishermen may have planned differently.
It's very interesting that a price came out pretty much at the end of the season. And they had all our fish. right? The fish have been caught, and then Trident posts 50 cents a pound.
Shane Blau has been fishing in Alaska for 35 years. He fishes for Trident and helped organize this protest. His children crew on his boat in the summers, but he has discouraged them from buying into the fishery.
You know, the last thing you want is your children to get strapped to hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt and then have the rug pulled out from under them. And that's what's going on. I didn't think it would happen quite this way, quite this fast.
Adjusted for inflation, this year's base price is the lowest recorded price in nearly 40 years, since 1984. But Blau says he's seen the quality of the fish sold to processors improve over that time. That's due to fishermen's investment in equipment and labor, according to Blau, such as refrigerated seawater and extra deckhands for bleeding fish. But he says these investments are not reflected in prices offered by the processors.
And what do we get in return? We get half the price. And in my opinion, the processors need to do better. I cannot believe I've been fishing 35 years and I'm fishing for less base price than I did when I was in my teenage years.
Anna Mounsey is a skipper on the fishing vessel Siren. She says younger members of the fleet, like herself, are questioning if this industry is worth buying into.
Just seeing if it's even worth it with just how much it fluctuates, not being able to count on making boat payments and all the other expenses that come with just starting out, being young and watching this graying fleet leave. What hope do us young fishermen have with the vulnerability of this market?
Some fishing crews heard the news and promptly ended their season. Others continued fishing, ending an otherwise strong season with a harvest of over 36 million fish to date. Co-reported with Christina McDermott, Corinne Smith, and Jack Darrell, in Naknek, I'm Jesse Sheldon.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, young burn survivors get hooked on Alaska.
My first salmon I ever caught in my life was the biggest of the day.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. There are many ways to support your local public media station. Donate now and arrange to make a planned gift as a bequest. Your legacy will stretch from today to many tomorrows.
State game managers are pushing back on research that says Alaska's predator control programs don't work. A paper by two retired state biologists and a University of Alaska Fairbanks professor says an analysis of harvest numbers in Game Management Unit 13, that's in south central Alaska, showed moose harvests did not improve in the years following predator control. The state disputes that finding, and Tom Paragai, a biologist with the Division of Wildlife Conservation, points to other research. Paragai says other studies back up the notion that predator control can help declining populations of prey like moose.
What's fairly common in the boreal region of Alaska, it was something shown in a landmark study that came out in 1992 by department staff, where they reviewed case studies of moose, 35 sites across Alaska and Yukon. And what they found is that when populations of moose declined to low abundance, which is typically less than about one per square mile, they can stay there and fluctuate a little bit from year to year in areas where the large predators, wolves and bears, remain at their natural densities. And what they found in some of those case studies is that where predators had been reduced through harvest or predator control, that allowed those moose populations to increase in abundance to more than one moose per square mile. And they would remain there, and once predator control stopped, they would remain there for a period of time. But over time, as the predators fell back into the area and increased to their prior abundance, and especially if you have then things like a severe winter, that can in turn cause a decline back down.
I just want to be really clear. I mean, one thing that those researchers had said was that the state doesn't have the scientific framework to back up the notion that predator control does work as intended. And it sounds like you're saying that that's not true, that the state does have the scientific framework to back that up. Is that accurate?
Yeah, the intensive management law came about in 1994. And at that point, there had been a couple decades of research in interior and south central Alaska that had looked at the effects of wolf and bear predation on moose and caribou populations. And they found that there are circumstances where when prey populations get to some lower levels, predation can hold them at those levels. And in terms of Unit 13, another thing that I looked at was there were four subunits that had wolf control in them. And those are the ones that were driving this trend you saw in Unit 13, where the population was declining and harvest declined until the early 2000s. And after wolf control, they increased. Now, one question you might ask on that, is there another factor that maybe led to the increase? One of the common things to look at is winter severity, and it turns out that winter severity has been comparatively mild in since those predator control programs compared to historic periods. But an important thing is I also looked at two different moose survey areas nearby there, one in Unit 13D and one in Wrangell-St. Elias National Park, which is east across the Copper River. And both those areas during the same period of the 1990s and well into around 2020, they were at low density and they stayed at low density. So the areas that didn't have wolf control stayed at low density. The four areas that did have wolf control increased in abundance and they allowed more harvest of moose.
Well, so Tom, I have to ask, I mean, I've talked to the acting director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation now, Ryan Scott, and you, and It sounds like you just kind of reject this idea that this study puts forward that predator control doesn't work. And so, I just have to ask, I mean, do you think that these researchers are just completely off base or what?
The key thing to remember about intensive management or about predator management is that it's very strongly driven by values, both for it and against it, by different members of the public. And science is not going to answer that question. The science behind the potential for predators to regulate prey at relatively low levels in boreal forest, it's largely been shown over several decades. There's probably close to 50 years of research now that has shown there are situations where it can occur. It doesn't mean that every situation is held low by predation. And there are some situations where predator management is not going to be feasible. The Board of Game, because of the intensive management law and the objectives that are set, they're required to consider factors when prey populations get low and then they have to restrict harvest. They're required to consider different factors. But the law itself, the statute, describes situations where it may not be appropriate and the board is not required to take action. And that's due to scientific factors. For example, if you had very poor nutrition in an area for the prey population, and they would have little chance to grow even if you reduce natural predation. That's one situation. Another one is land ownership. Department of Fish and Game has not and is not been doing predator control on national park or national wildlife refuge lands that are about 40% of the state. And the third reason is when it's not in the best interest of subsistence uses. And what that means is that if increasing the number of hunters in an area substantially is going to cause a lot of social conflict, that's another reason the board does not have to implement a predator control program.
I think, too, it's probably worth mentioning, right, that, I mean, those values, they essentially are aimed at providing hunters with an opportunity to put meat on the table, right?
Absolutely. The intent behind the intensive management law is to increase harvest of moose, caribou, and deer in areas where it's important for human uses, where it's been documented through a long history of use. But the values, it's everybody weighs in on the values, and it's through the political process that those values get decided. But, intensive management, any type of wildlife management, it can be science-informed. The design of the programs can be based on science, as the intensive management programs are based on, like I said, decades of research showing that in certain situations, predation can limit them. But ultimately, implementing those programs is a political decision. It's a values decision. And the biologists, to try to stay out of those kind of debates, that's our role, is to provide the objective information so that all sides and all values can speak to what they think is appropriate to do.
That was Division of Wildlife Conservation Research biologist Tom Paragai talking about why the state disputes the findings of a study that says predator control doesn't work. You can find an interview with one of the authors of that study at alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. Sustaining membership offers public media greater financial stability month to month, so consider making a sustaining gift to this station. Thank you.
A video of dogs facing off against a brown bear in a Kenai Peninsula backyard has captured attention online. But as KDLL's Riley Board reports, some locals say that's just life in Alaska.
The small central peninsula town of Cooper Landing is having a surprising moment of internet virality. An Instagram video of four dogs sparring with a brown bear has more than 30,000 likes, and a reposted version on Facebook has more than 1,000 shares. A USA Today article describes the video as capturing an intense battle between a brown bear and dogs. The video was taken this month on Jen Harp's property in Cooper Landing. She's a dog trainer, but says the dogs featured in the video are her own personal pets, and they weren't necessarily trained for the task.
For the most part, it's instinctual for these guys. And, you know, I've had dogs that protect the property for generations, and so one dog teaches the next.
Harp says the bear in the video got closer and closer to the property over the course of several weeks, until it was about 20 feet away from her deck. In the video, the bear has visible injuries around its neck. Jacob Pelham, a wildlife biologist out of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Office in Soldotna, says this bear isn't any more dangerous than any others in the area, and hasn't been aggressive toward people, as far as he knows. Harp's neighbor, Michelle Donahue, also got a visit from that bear. She and her husband first saw it on their home surveillance camera. They're used to having movement on camera because of the dogs next door at Harp's house.
So the camera goes off a lot and we'll go, dogs, dogs, you know, just being funny. We are coming up the hill about a half mile, just coming up the road, and it went off and we weren't dogs. And Todd picked up his phone and looked at it and he goes, nope, it's a bear.
She says it looked like a juvenile and she could see its injuries on video. She said for weeks, a neighbor group chat buzzed with texts warning of the bear's location and its curiosity toward people. But Donahue says that's just a part of life in Cooper Landing.
I mean, this is where we live. We live in bear country. And so I think everyone needs to do is just keep your garbage picked up and keep your yards clean, and we can all live together just fine. I think you expect that when you move where you move. I mean, we're in the middle of Cooper Landing. You're going to have bears.
Pelham, with Fish and Game, says his advice to residents is just to remove all bear attractants and hope the bear moves on. Harp says she never expected for the video to go viral, and she doesn't read many of the comments. She says she lives in the woods for a reason. On the Kenai Peninsula, I'm Riley Board.
Young burn survivors from Indiana are spending over a week in Ketchikan as part of a traveling summer camp. The Hoosier Burn Camp takes participants to different places each summer, but it's the first time the group traveled to Alaska or even got on a plane together. As Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports, the trip has been a lifetime experience for some of the campers.
The campers range in age from 15 to 20, a little older than the camp's usual traveling groups. This way, they can do more stuff in Alaska, like fishing for salmon.
Fishing was great. I just love fishing, and it's just exciting.
That's Jace. I caught up with him and others on a call during one of their breaks. The camp asked me to only use the teens' first names. Some of them have had dozens of reconstructive surgeries, and the camp gives them an opportunity to just be a tourist and step away from the stress.
My first salmon I ever caught in my life was the biggest of the day.
Austin was the very last camper to hook a fish on their boating trip south of town. He had doubts it would even happen.
I was basically speechless once I caught it. I was just so happy, and that meant the world to me. Because I didn't expect to catch a salmon that big, and I did it, so I've been pretty happy since then.
The group of mostly teenagers also walked through old-growth forests, rode e-bikes around town, and took sightseeing flights. Flying was one of Jace's favorite activities.
I just thought it'd always be cool to go on a float plane. And then we actually did. And laying down the lake out there, saw a whole bunch of mountains. It was really cool. Looked beautiful out there.
There has been sea kayaking and beach walking where they saw a bear and seals. Austin likes some of the smaller creatures too.
We've seen a sea cucumbers. We've seen that red spiky thing. Do you remember the name of that, Abby?
Anemone. Oh, the urchins, yeah.
That thing was really, really cool. I didn't even know they existed.
Hoosier Burn Camp was started by the Indiana State Fire Marshal and a children's hospital about 25 years ago. Its programs help kids rehabilitate physically and mentally from their burns. Mark Koopman is the executive director and is traveling with the group.
In some instances, we work with children that have had 40, 50, 60 reconstructive surgeries before they turn 18.
He says that changes the way they see the world and how they experience summer camps.
The physical trauma associated with that is exponentially difficult, and it's hard to wrap into words. But then when you talk about the psychological trauma associated with burn injury, that's a whole nother thing.
But he says sometimes the kids look forward to the surgeries too, when they help bring their bodies to their full potential, making trips like this one to Alaska possible. Koopman says their trip relied heavily on local donations like housing in a church and discounts on adventures. Ketchikan's fire chief Rick Hines helped make connections. He hails from Indianapolis and fought fires there for decades before retiring and moving to Ketchikan. He says Ketchikan generously welcomed the campers.
Everybody that we reached out to through the Hoosier Burn Camp was like, yep, tip my guides. You can go on this excursion for free. Or, you know what? I won't do any charters to stay and I'll take your folks out on my boat. Or I'm going to charge you the minimum I can to operate or cycle my plane, you know, for three trips.
Hines says the Hoosier Burn Camp is well known in Indiana. He relates to the campers in more ways than one. He's also a survivor. He burned his right arm on the job.
The one takeaway really is the amount of pain that these kids have endured, because there's no amount of pain medicine that can take away the physical pain they endure, you know, let alone the mental pain.
So when the campers had the chance to take a dip in the cold salt water on a cloudy day and go all the way under, many, like Austin, said yes.
We're here to have fun, make great memories. And that right there, that is definitely a great memory that I will never forget on this trip, never forget in my lifetime.
Campers not only hooked salmon on the trip, but several got hooked on Alaska and say they most definitely will be coming back. Reporting for Coast Alaska in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early in Anchorage, Jesse Sheldon in Naknek, Riley Borden in Kenai, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
In your arms so tight, you let me go. Everything's all right.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station. We're glad to have you tuning in, and we'd love to welcome you as a member. Make a donation to this station and be a part of the public media family. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.